Okay, we're rolling. Just a reminder, if I'm not mistaken, the Jewish Center Clergy Pearls, in preparation for Pesach, they'll be offering, myself included, insights into the Haggadah, into the nature of Pesach, things that can be discussed at the Pesach Seder, things that are more long form. There'll be what to enjoy for everybody. The entire clergy takes part. That is taking place, I believe, on Tuesday, March 31st. Stay tuned for further.
Before we leave, not that very convenient.
We'll stay tuned for updates from the from Elian from the Jewish Center.
It's not going to be a clergy this Wednesday because Daniel Friedman's wife interfered.
I'll help out however I can. I know it's terribly inconsiderate of. Okay. All right, so that reminds me, Mazel Tov, of course, to Rabbi Daniel Friedman and Chaya Friedman on the birth of a boy?
Or
a girl. Of a girl.
Eliana.
Wow, beautiful. So Mazel Tov. Also, one additional note, if you'll permit me. Last week was the second yard site of my aunt, Allah Shalom, Aunt Sarah Lam Drach, Sarifka Bas Harav Nachum Umindel, and if it's all right with all of you, the learning that we do this evening will be Le'ilei Nishmata. I should note there are people in the room who knew Sarah. We all remember her with great fondness, and those memories should be what carry us forward, and what carry her forward in our hearts and in our words and actions. Yeah. Okay. We are going to pick up where we left off last time, but just in case we all need a refresher, I'll just review. What we saw last time was that it appeared at the beginning of our investigation that we had identified a source in the Chumash, the pasuk in particular of "V'higadta levincha bayom ahu le'mor bavor zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeisim mitzrayim," and God instructs the Jewish people, "Tell your son on that day," which we interpreted at first to mean Chag Hamatzos, which had been mentioned in the pasuk previous, "and on that day, tell your child about all of the things that I have done for you, or that because of this." Because of these things, and in particular, we thought that might mean the narrative that you're relating to your children, or perhaps the things that are present in front of you during a prototypical Seder on Pesach night. "Because of these things, I took the Jewish people out of Egypt." So we thought that we had identified, on the pshat level, a straightforward biblical source for the notion that there is a special commandment, a special mitzvah, on the night of Pesach, to relate the story of the Exodus, or at least to relate matters concerning the Exodus. We then proceeded to note that if it's the case, indeed, that there is a straightforward biblical source telling us that we have to tell the story of Pesach, or relate the laws of Pesach, perhaps, or both, on Pesach night, then it would be strange indeed not to find any mention among the several sources that we have from times dating to the temple to the times of the Beis HaMikdash, describing the celebration of Pesach, in particular the night of Pesach, the night when the Karban Pesach, when the Paschal Lamb was slaughtered, how strange it is that there's no mention of anybody relating the story of the Exodus. We noticed how strange that was, and it cried out for explanation. How could generations of Jews, at least at the level of what the evidence can reasonably tell us, if ignored, a straightforward biblical verse? We proceeded to then demonstrate that in fact the verse does not mean what we thought it meant at first, and there are good grounds, there's in fact good rabbinic precedent to read the key terms in this verse in such a way that it means v'higadta levincha bayom ahu, not on that day on Chag HaPesach. But Bayom Ahu, in the broader sense, as the Radak said, b'chol ba'es hahi, right? At some time in the future, namely when you enter into the land of Israel, which is how that entire parsha had begun, one day down the road, you will tell your children that because of all of the things that I have done for you, you will observe all of the mitzvahs having to do with Pesach, namely slaughtering the Paschal sacrifice, not eating chametz, eating matzos, and so on and so forth. So we saw that, in fact, at the simple level, the verse isn't describing the process of telling the story of Pesach at all. All it's doing is saying what in the future will transpire, namely, one day you'll live in the land of Israel and you'll observe all of the laws that I'm telling you. So we saw that, in fact, at the simple level, there is no source in the Chumash or anywhere in Tanakh for telling the story of Pesach on the night of the Seder. And we noted, therefore, that or at least perhaps we implied that this might be one way out of the classic conundrum that's raised when Pesach time rolls around, which is how could we have two mitzvos that overlap so substantially? The mitzvah to tell the story of Pesach on Pesach night, and the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias, the first one would be Sipor Yetzias Mitzrayim, telling the story, and the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim, remembering the Exodus, which is something that is incumbent upon us all year round. How could we have two mitzvahs that just overlap so blatantly? So what we implied is that, in fact, on a simple level, there is no overlap, because there's only one mitzvah, the mitzvah of recalling Yetzias Mitzrayim, and in fact, recalling the Exodus needn't necessarily be done through telling the story of the Exodus. It could be done through performing deeds, whether it be sanctifying the firstborn, or whether it be slaughtering the Korban Pesach, or what have you. Now, we did note, however, and we'll review the evidence right here at the top in source number one, we did note that there is a strain of rabbinic thought that does, in fact, assert that there is a biblical commandment to tell the story of Pesach on Pesach night, and that is the Mechilta.
Why is this important?
We're going to get to that in a second, but right now we're just reviewing what we did last time. The Mechilta is, in fact, the source that reads the Pasuk of Vigadat Levincha very much against the simple explanation to mean that there is a requirement to tell the story of Pesach on Pesach night. So the question that we have to ask now is twofold. One, does this view of the Mechilta, that there is a biblical commandment to tell the story of Pesach on Pesach night, does this commandment, which seems to be assumed by all of the Achronim, does this in fact make it into the halachic literature, at least at an early stage? In other words, can we find it in the Gemara? Can we find it in the Mishnah? Can we find it in the can we find it in the Haggadah? Is it in our Haggadah? In other words, is it reflected in the liturgy that we use on Pesach? And then number two, and I think more importantly, we have to ask a broader conceptual question, and that is, what are we doing on Pesach night? We're telling the story. Okay. I think we all understand at an intellectual level that what we are engaged in when we recite the Haggadah is halachically meaningful. In other words, we all realize that at some level we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. But I think we need to concretize it a little bit more. What are we accomplishing by, at least nominally, and sometimes very formulaically? In other words, people aren't going around narrating ad hoc the story of the Exodus. We're reciting a script that's been handed to us. So what are we doing? And to what extent are we engaged in something that is positive? Is there a biblical value at stake? And if not, is there a rabbinical value at stake? And if the answer to either of those questions is yes, what is that value? And why is it something that remains, I mean, halakhically, of course, it doesn't matter whether or not it's relevant. But why does it, I think, in an intellectual, maybe hashkafic, machshavic sense, why does it remain relevant to us? So those are the questions that we're going to have to ask at every stage over the course of our analysis. So, with that in mind, what I'd like to do is just review the evidence, and then I'd like to call attention to some anomalies. So, take a look at the first two sources. We're going to do source 1A and then 1B. 1A is the Mechilta from last time, so we'll review it very quickly. The Mechilta says, "V'igadat levincha, shomea ani mirosh chodesh, tamid lomar bayomahu. O bayomahu, shomea ani mi beod yom, tamid lomar bavorzeh." The verse says, and you shall tell your son. Ah, so you will tell your son about the story of the Exodus. That could be any time. It doesn't have to be at a particular time. It could be from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. You already have to engage in the mitzvah of Haggadah. So that is why the verse says, on that day. Or perhaps from on that day, I hear that it is that this is while it's still a day. In other words, by Yom Ahu perhaps means the day that you're shechting the Karban Pesach, while it's still daylight outside. So scripture tells us, because of this, when unleavened bread and bitter herbs lie before him upon the table. So we noted last time why Chazal think Ba'avor Zeh can be taken to refer to something that's in front of you right now. The details are not as important. But in any event, it's clear from this source in the Mechilta that the Mechilta thinks that there is scriptural warrant for telling the story of the Exodus on Pesach night. That it's a mitzvah midoraisa. It's not enough just to recall the miracle of the Exodus and its generative import for our national history. In other words, it's what creates us as a people. It's not enough to recall that every day. There's a special mitzvah on Pesach, midoraisa, to do this. Okay. Similarly, and you'll see why I'm pointing to this source, which seems to say much the same thing in a moment. Take a look at source 1b. Source 1b is from the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So broadly speaking, the difference between Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael and Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is first of all that Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael can generally be assumed to be earlier. And perhaps more importantly, the traditions of the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael reflect the traditions that were... that can, broadly speaking, be attributed to the school of Rabbi Yishmael, the Tana Rabbi Yishmael and his students. Those are the Tanaim mostly that are mentioned there, although, of course, there are exceptions. Whereas the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, which is a little bit of a later midrash, and it gets augmented as time goes on, can be attributed mostly to the school of Rabbi Akiva and his Talmidim. Now, so the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai tells us, Vayomer Moshe el Ha'am, Zachor es Hayom Hazeh. So the verse tells us, and Moses said to the people, remember this day, the day that God took the Jewish people out of Egypt. So the Mechilta tells us, and Moses said to the people, remember this day, from the fact that it said, when your son shall ask you tomorrow, saying, perhaps only, you are only required to relate the story of the Exodus if your son asks you about it. But how do I know that even if he didn't ask you, you have to tell him the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim on Pesach night? So, because scripture says, you shall tell your son, even if he didn't ask you. Now, all I have is a case when he has a son, but what is the source for telling the story to himself, or relating the story to somebody who's not his son. So scripture teaches, and Moses said to the people, remember this day. Now, here's my question. According to these two sources, what are the two relevant verses that in which the obligation to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim on Pesach night is anchored? What are the two verses? Right? V'higadta l'vincha, that's one. And Vayomer Moshe el Ha'am. Okay, those are the two verses. Exodus 13.3 and Exodus 13.8. Okay. Now, question number two. What are the contours, in other words, what are the details of this biblical mitzvah according to the Mechiltos? So what do you have to do? Right, so in other words, there's a component of remembering. So in other words, you have to relate the story. Now, to whom? Anyone. Your child, there's a special obligation for your child, right? Especially if your child asks you, right? That's what the verse says, when your son shall ask you tomorrow. So you have to tell your child, but even if you don't have a child, you have to tell anyone who's there, whether that's another person who's not your child or whether it's yourself. Okay. Those things, yes.
Okay.
That's an excellent point. We should note at the outset that it is certainly true, as we saw with the case of Higadat Levincha, that the simple meaning of this pasuk is not that it's referring to Pesach night and a concurrent or a concomitant obligation to tell the story of Pesach on that night. So that is a good point. In other words, this isn't the pashut pshat of the verse, and that's actually important to note, as we'll see in a moment. But yeah, so let's keep that on the register. Yeah.
But if you accept that Haggadah as we know it today really didn't come into existence till the 9th century of the Common Era, they left Egypt 1500 before the Common Era. So from the, you take 8, it's 2300 years before you had a real structure of something. What really took place? I mean, this one said this and this one said that.
Right.
I mean, how did it work? I mean, one family did one thing and one family did another.
Right, so let's unpack this a little bit. Number one, the question is, what are the earliest texts of a Haggadah that we have? Not the Haggadah, let's say, but a Haggadah that we have. So it's, right. So it's true. In other words, a full-fledged sort of Siddur text, right? That Siddurim don't emerge as such until the Gaonic period. That's right. So the 9th century is as good a date as any. It is true, though, as Dr. Schwartzbaum also notes. So in other words, Mr. Deegan is absolutely correct. Dr. Schwartzbaum is also right to note that there are antecedents, even if they're not sort of in the form of a Siddur, in earlier texts, like the Mishnah, the 10th parak of Maseches Pesachim, has essentially what is a Seder, right? It tells you how to conduct a meal with a liturgy on Pesach night. So, on the other hand, however, we've seen that all of the evidence from the time when there was a temple standing, a Beis HaMikdash standing, is that there was no Haggadah. So the Haggadah seems to have arisen or coalesced at some point between when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and when the Mishnah was edited. That's sort of the latest point beyond which we know there's already Haggadah. So let's say the 3rd century of the Common Era. But Mr. Deegan's question still holds, which is, in other words, to what degree is the proximity of the Mishnah to Yetzias Mitzrayim significant in terms of the Mishnah having any special insight into what went on in Yetzias Mitzrayim? Putting aside questions of Masorah and how Masorah works, just in a very basic sense. In other words, I don't have any particular insight into the Pashup Shot of Shakespeare any more than someone who lives 20 years from now will have a sense. So Kavachomer is something that happens so much further back than that. What special insight do they have? So now we can bring back in questions of Masorah. In other words, tradition at a certain point and handing down traditions is very much part and parcel of how this is supposed to work and how it's supposed to preserve much older traditions. So that's answer number one. But answer number two is that, in fact, at a certain point, we're going to have to say, look, the Haggadah is an innovation. And having a text of a Haggadah, we've already seen last time, to a certain extent, is an innovation, because it doesn't appear at any point in Bayesheni. So I think, instead of asking, in other words, what does the Haggadah tell us about Yetzias Mitzrayim that can serve as, in other words, something that would have gone back all the way to Yetzias Mitzrayim, that may be one important question, but I think another important question, which is one that I want to ask, is, let's assume that the Haggadah is a later creation. It's relatively early from a rabbinic perspective, but within the context of biblical history, it's a much later development. So even so, it's possible that the Mechilta really has discovered something that is latent in the biblical text that wasn't available to Philo or wasn't available to someone in the time, to Divrei HaYamim. It's very possible. In fact, in terms of how rabbinic hermeneutics are supposed to work, according to the Rambam, it's certainly possible that that could be the case. So we have to ask ourselves, to what extent is what is going on in the Haggadah consonant with biblical values? And to what extent is it not? And perhaps it reflects rabbinic values. And we'll have to discuss what those might be. Yes?
Can we also look at it as, you know, after the Bar Kokhba rebellion is put down, Judaism is like falling apart. And the rabbis are saying, okay, so we haven't had a Korban Pesach. We're not celebrating Pesach the same way.
Right.
So now it's losing its connection to the people. The people aren't educated. So maybe the rabbis do something to...
Right.
So it's the whole concept of what the rabbinic authority is doing at this point and saying, how do we continue...
Sure.
The religion. Forget about the tradition. Just
right.
To concretize what we've been doing. So, I'm just wondering how that played a part in this.
So that may very well be important. In other words, the Rambam's theory of how Torah Shebaal Peh comes to be, of how oral Torah comes to be written down, is rooted very much in crisis, right? There's a crisis, and lest it be lost, it had to be written down. Pashup Shad, as far as we can tell from historical standpoint, is that that's not the case. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi lived in a time of great prosperity and safety, but you may be, but in other words, you're certainly correct that the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which would be a century or so earlier than Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, would represent a time of crisis, and that might be the impetus for something like this. Well, we're going to come back to that hopefully at the end, but for now, the question that I'm interested in, and that's why I want to quickly take a look at source number C, is the question of whether we're dealing with a bona fide biblical mitzvah or not. And whether or not we are, what does our Haggadah think? In other words, we have a Haggadah that we recite every single year. What do we think? In other words, how has history paskened? History can paskin, not just Rebbeim. History can paskin. That's what Minhag is. Right? That's why Minhag is as much a text as anything else. So how is history paskin? So take a look at source number C, and bear in mind that we identified two verses that are the source for this whole complex of magid, right? Of telling the story to your child, to yourself, to anyone who will listen on Pesach night. So take a look at the Bavli, and this the Bavli in this respect is representative of really the entire scope of the Mishnah, the Talmud, and the Yerushalmi, because those sources do not differ from the Bavli in this respect. Look at the Bavli. Bavli says, first quoting the Mishnah, "Mazgulo kos sheni v'kana ben shoel aviv." The second cup is mixed, and here the son asks his father. V'mein das b'ven aviv malamdo. And if the son is incompetent, so his father teaches him how to ask. And then the Gemara tells us, Tana Rabbanan, chacham b'no sho'alo, v'meino chacham ishto sho'alatu, v'mlav hu sho'al atzmo. So the sages teach, if his son is wise, he is the one who asks the father. And if he's not wise, then the wife will ask the father. And if there is nobody to ask, so then the husband, who's presumably leading the Seder, will ask himself. Now, have we seen anything here that's fundamentally or radically different from what we've seen in the Mechilta? At least in terms of what the law is? What do we think? So I see a shrug, I think that's the right answer. Nothing really, right? I mean, Jeffrey's right, right? There's nothing really. However, what is radically different about this source with respect to how the Mechilta frames things? What's missing in this source?
The asking is not as important as the telling.
Ah, so Sally's correct. In other words, there may be a substantive difference here, which is that the it's not as important as that the child asks. In other words, and I think Sally's headed in the right direction, right? Which is that here, if the child doesn't know how to ask, the father teaches the child how to ask, right? So there's something important about the telling. Why would that be, though? What's missing here? In other words, in the Mechilta, there's a reason to think that the asking is what's important, and what is that reason?
Effectively eliminated the word of the Mincha. I mean, it's begadata irrespective of who's there.
Ah, so you're telling me that the Mishnah and the Gemara are understanding the Psukim a little bit differently than how the Mechilta understood them. Now here's my question. How do you know? Does the Mishnah or the Gemara mention anything about Psukim?
No.
That's a big difference. There's no Psukim here. Right? I think that's what Sally's getting at, right? The reason why the Mechilta thinks, uses the framework of asking, is because it's being guided by Psukim. Ki ish alcha bin chamacha, when your child will ask you tomorrow. But the Mishnah and the Gemara here aren't concerned with Psukim at all. As far as the Mishnah and the Bavli is concerned, these are rabbinical laws. There are no psukim that appear to support these laws in the Mishnah, in the Tosefta, in the Yerushalmi, in the Bavli, or anywhere else other than in these Midrashei Halacha in the Mechilta. That is significant. And in fact, take a look at source D. Source D is from Midrash Seichel Tov. You can find Seichel Tov on the bookshelves of the standard-based Midrash today. Midrash Seichel Tov is one of those Midrashim that, and there are many of them, that pop up in the medieval period. It's not Tanaitic, certainly it's not Amoraic either, but it may contain early traditions, but it's put together at least, and in this case we know who wrote it, it's put together in probably in Italy in the 12th century, in the year 1139, and here's how Midrash Seichel Tov reads. Mazgu lo kosheni v'kan haben shoel em ein das b'ven lishol aviv melamdo. They mix for him the second cup, and here the son asks. If the son is incompetent to ask, his father teaches him. Where have we seen that text before? that wording before? Above, in which source? In the Mishnah. Did the Mishnah cite a pasuk for this? No, it did not. But what does Midrash Seichel Tov say? Shene'emar, v'hi gadat levincha b'yom ahu le'mor, b'vor zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeisim b'mitzrayim. It quotes the pasuk of v'hi gadat levincha. The pasuk of v'hi gadat levincha is the source for telling the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim. In which source? In the Mechilta. Moreover, Tana Rabbanan, im chacham b'no, b'no sho'alo, v'im lav hu ba'atzmo sho'el, shene'emar zachores as yom hazeh asher yitzasim b'mitzrayim. If his son is wise, as his child will ask him, and if not, he asks himself, as it says, remember this day upon which you left Egypt. The notion of different types of children asking a father, and if a father doesn't have children to ask, asking himself, so that language that's been quoted here comes straight from the Gemara, comes straight from the Bavli. But the proof text comes from the Mechilta. So what the Midrash here has picked up on is the fact that in the Mechilta, this is seen as an absolute biblical requirement, whereas in the Bavli, it's seen as a din derabanan.
Yeah, it's always my understanding that you put no paskin on Midrash.
Well, in other words, let's back up for a second and clarify some terminology. This is, first of all, Ms. Bernstein's absolutely correct. We don't generally, and there are exceptions.
Yeah.
But generally, we don't paskin based on when you say Midrash. So let's refine our terminology, because this is a very important point. So usually when we refer to Midrash in our modern-day nomenclature, so what do we usually mean by Midrash? Stories, right? Like Agada, right? Agadata, right? Now, the sources that we're dealing with here, which are technically speaking also Midrash and Midrashei Halacha, so Midrash there is being used in a different way. Midrash, when we use the term Midrash to describe the Mechilta, or to describe the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael, to describe the Mechilta de Rashbi, is being used simply to describe the process of deriving a law from a biblical verse. Literally a Midrash, right? A drash, right? A person can be Doresh, a Midrash, from a pasuk. There are two types of Midrash, broadly speaking. There are Midrashei Agada, which are generally homiletical, like Breishis Rabbah, and so forth. But there are also Midrashei Halacha, like the Mechilta, like the Sifra, the Mechilta is commenting on Sefer Shmos. The Sifra is commenting on Vayikra. The Sifrei will comment, for example, on Bamidbar and Devarim. Those are Midrashei Halacha. Those are commenting on legal verses and simply deriving laws from them, or taking laws that are already known and hanging them on those psukim. Those both types of drashos appear. Rav David Zvi Hoffman called one a midrash somech, and I can't remember the other terminology that he uses. But there are two types of midrash, and one is really where the pasuk actually creates the law, and one is where the law is already known and they're kind of hanging that on a pasuk. But in any event, when we say we don't paskin for midrash, what we usually mean is that we don't, by and large, there are exceptions, we don't usually paskin halacha based on rabbinic narratives, but when it comes to deriving laws from psukim, which is what we mean when we say midrash halacha, that we do, on the basis of that, we certainly do paskin. That's an excellent point. Okay.
The reason I brought it up was what I think is a very important point here. Going to fight off a tangent, but God. Is a very famous from the Talmud midrash called Three Oats, which I think you're familiar with. Them?
What's the midrash?
The Three Oats.
Oh yeah, right. The Gimel Shavuos.
Correct.
Right, yeah.
Correct. Okay. So the reason why I heard why we
anyway.
we don't follow it is because it's midrash and we don't paskin on midrash.
Right.
Okay. So what you're saying is, because, just so I understand, so when somebody,
right,
people will bring this up, we don't follow it, it's not halacha, or it's not something we follow, because it's rabbinic story?
Right, so this would take us, this is a fascinating question, in other words, this relates to legitimizing the question of the legitimacy of the Zionist project. It's going to take us too far afield. I don't want to get into it now, but it is an excellent question. That is certainly one of the answers, the classic answers that's been proffered to blunt the attack from that source in rabbinic literature. But we're going to leave that aside for now.
And it's also an answer that within
correct. Excellent question. We're going to leave it for now because it'll take us too far afield. But excellent question. Okay, now. Here's the question that we need to ask ourselves now. In terms of figuring out whether this law is biblical, and in which case we really have no further questions. In other words, if it's biblical, then this is just, we observe this law like we observe the Karban Pesach. It doesn't quite matter what it's doing here. It just is a law, and that's what we have to do. If it's a rabbinical law, if the law of telling the story of the Exodus is a rabbinical innovation, so we have to ask ourselves, why would Chazal do this? Right? In other words, what principle were Chazal enunciating when they're making this law? So the first question that we have to ask ourselves is, how do we effectively paskin, to the extent that there's psak involved here? In other words, what has filtered down into our tradition? So here's the question that's going to be relevant on Pesach night. And this can, I think this can guide a discussion on Pesach night. What does our Haggadah say? How does our Haggadah paskin in this question? And how do we know? So this text, where does this text, in other words, when we say V'chan HaBen Shoel, and here the son asks, or the child asks, so what are we referring to when we say ask, when we talk about asking? What text are we referring to? Manishtana. Okay. So the child asks, and what answer does the child get? Avadim Hayinu. That's how we classically understand this text. Now, in Avadim Hayinu, actually I've given you the text here in 2a. So take a look at 2a. This is the standard text in the Ashkenazic Haggadah that we use. Now, as a preface, there are two, broadly said, there are lots of different Haggadah texts, but they, broadly speaking, coalesce around two different versions. There's a Babylonian version, and there's an Eretz Yisrael version. The Eretz Yisrael version, which is reflected mostly, as far as we can tell, in fragments from the Geniza, from the Cairo Geniza, the Eretz Yisrael version is very, very different from the Babylonian version. It's much shorter. And it also paskins for the most part based on the Yerushalmi and traditions that we find in the Yerushalmi, as the Talmud Yerushalmi, as you would expect. It doesn't have Avadim Hayinu to begin with, so it's not going to really enter our discussion here. And more importantly, our Haggadah, the Haggadah that really everybody today uses, is some version of the Babylonian tradition of the Haggadah. The Babylonian tradition seems to have won out over time. There are, however, many different branches of the Babylonian tradition. We are going now to have to now investigate how our version, the version that we use on our Seder night, came to be, and why it's important to understand where that version came from. So this is what everybody in this room is going to read on Pesach night. We're all going to read the following. Avadim hayinu l'paravim Mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. That much we're all aware of. God took us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and so forth. And had God not taken us out of Egypt, we would still be there to this very day. Now, va'afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nivonim, kulanu zakenim, kulanu yodim asatora. And even if all of us were sages par excellence, all of us were fully trained, Talmid HaChachamim, at the top of our game, mitzvah aleinu l'saper b'yitzias Mitzrayim, it is a mitzvah for us to tell the story of the Exodus, v'chol hamarbe l'saper b'yitzias Mitzrayim, harei ze meshubach. And anyone who lengthens their practice of narrating the Exodus is praiseworthy. Question. How does our Haggadah text paskin? Is it a biblical commandment? Is there any commandment? Or is it perhaps something else? There are no psukim here on the one hand, but it's certainly right, so Sally's also correct as well, right? It certainly is seen as a commandment. Right, so generally speaking, as we're going to see, this is complicated. But generally speaking, mitzvah, at least in Tannaitic literature, so mitzvah is generally used to describe a biblical commandment. We're going to see there are certainly exceptions to this, or many exceptions to this, but mitzvah is usually going to be used to generate a biblical obligation, as I think it is. I think it is here in this text. It's being understood as at least potentially as biblical obligation. Now, how do we know, at the very least, that there is a commandment, a basic commandment, to tell the story of the Exodus? What's the proof? But what does the last sentence tell us? Right, Harei Zeh Meshubach. Why is that important? In other words, what can you do that is praiseworthy? You can go on and on, right? You can do more than what is basically required. Right, exactly. Right, Sally's correct. There is a baseline upon which you can build, right? But that means there certainly must be a baseline, right? There must be a baseline.
There is a pasuk in here. It's in Hashem.
Right, correct.
I mean, I know it's not a pasuk that discusses specifically about
right.
Before,
you're also correct,
but,
right.
But you are actually coming to a some form of answer.
Right. I think you're right. The atmosphere, if you will, of this keta is biblical. In other words, this text sees itself fully within the biblical world, right? The story of the Exodus, right? As the Exodus is happening, this generates a mitzvah aleinu l'saper b'tzias Mitzrayim, and I think that's correct. So, at least from the perspective of this text, I would argue that there is understood in our Haggadah to be, at least at first glance, to be an absolute biblical commandment, right? There really isn't much to talk about. So, we could end here, but I think this is a very complex story. So, as I mentioned, our Haggadah reflects a long tradition of Babylonian, broadly speaking, texts of the Haggadah. And our Haggadah is the result of a long process of development in this respect. So the question we have to ask ourselves is this feature common to all of the Babylonian versions, and is it possible for us to identify what the earliest sort of, if we could even speak of such a thing, the purest version of that tradition may have been. So in fact, if you take a look at source B, the source B, and this goes back to a comment Mr. Deegan made before, this source is from probably the early 9th century. This is from the Siddur of Rav Sajigon. Rav Sajigon has a Siddur which essentially lays out the prayers for all year round. Communities will sort of use this as a baseline and graft other things onto it. But here is the text that Rav Sajigon gives us for Avadim Hayinu, the entire text. Avadim Hayinu l'parav b'Mitzrayim ve'yotzeinu Hashem Elokeinu misham b'yad chazaka uvuzra v'netuya ve'ilu lo gal HaKadosh Baruch Hu or rather Hamakom Baruch Hu avaseinu b'Mitzrayim kvar anu banenu v'nevanenu mishibadim Hayinu l'parav b'Mitzrayim. Were we slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord took we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord took us out of there with a mighty hand and outstretched arm. And had the Lord, blessed be He, not redeemed our forefathers from Egypt, we and our children's children would be enslaved to Pharaoh in Egypt. Period. What's missing? Mitzvah. The entire mitzvah is gone. There's no mitzvah aleinu l'saper b'tzias Mitzrayim. And a fortiori, there's no v'chol hamar b'lasapa harei zeh meshubach. Every version that depends on that of Rav Sajigon is missing this portion of Avadim Hayinu. So at a very early stage,
it's there, and
not in source B.
In B, it's what do you mean it's not B? It's just Avadim Hayinu.
Avadim Hayinu is present, but the line that articulates the notion that there is a commandment to tell the story of
you could assume that it's in there because it is being recited.
Well, we can't.
It doesn't say why it's being recited, but the fact that it is being recited. I mean,
well, perhaps. So here's the ask. So Mr. Kamen is raising an interesting question. So perhaps the fact that we're even telling a story at all, it must imply that there is an obligation to do so, right? That might be one implication that we're actually going to turn to that question right now.
And you're doing it year after year.
Every year you're doing
it.
That's right. I mean, this isn't in his Haggadah.
Well, so his Siddur includes his Haggadah as well. Yes, but excellent question, right? Dr. Schwartzman was raising a very important point. The Siddur of Rav Sajigon includes texts that are relevant to every holiday. Everything is under one roof. That's an important point. But Mr. Comet is raising a very important methodological question. In other words, look, fine. It doesn't articulate explicitly the fact that there is a mitzvah, there is a biblical commandment, or even any commandment, to tell the story of the Exodus on Pesach night. True. But we're doing it every year. So certainly there's a mitzvah.
Yeah, but even the fact that you start with this and not start with Abraham or Avinu is based upon the fact that you should tell your son on that, or your children on that night.
Right, so that I think that would that might further support that, in other words.
That you want to engage them, that they can understand a slave. They can't understand an idol.
Right, so in other words...
It's all out of chronological order.
Right, so here what we're doing, that's a good point, here what we're doing is we're engaging in some text that the logic of which is drawn from the verses themselves. I think that's correct. Now, or at least it's potentially correct. Now take a look at the next three sources which I've given you side by side, C, D, and E. Here we run into another roadblock. Because we've been assuming, and I think reasonably, and Mr. Comet articulated this clearly, that if we're telling the story at all, it must be because it's a mitzvah to do so. So even if our Haggadah doesn't say so, we can assume it. Now, it happens to be that there are three versions of that in the Babylonian tradition that are found amongst the major figures of our tradition. There are three versions, broadly speaking, of that line that we recite every year, Chalamar Balasapa Harizim Meshulach. The first one, which we've already seen, is source number C, V'chalamar Balasapa B'tzias Mitzrayim Harizim Meshulach. We don't need to review that. Now here is source number D. This is from the Rambam's Haggadah. The Rambam has V'chal Hamarech B'tzias Mitzrayim, or according to some manuscripts, according to some editions, V'chal Hamarech L'saper B'tzias Mitzrayim Harizim Meshulach. And anyone who expands the tale of the Exodus is praiseworthy. Is this very different from source C? Not really. It's more or less the same thing. The difference between Ma'arich and Marbeh is negligible at best. Now take a look. Now, these are both sources that are relatively late. Our Haggadah. The Rambam's Haggadah is earliest from the 12th century. Now go back 300 years before that. We get to the Seder of Rav Amram Gaon, one of the earliest sources, this is from the Gaonic period, the earliest attempts, rather, to create a liturgy. And here's the version of that line that we have in Rav Amram Gaon, and that we have amongst most of the Rishonim, in fact. The Ravan is the famous example. Among most of the Rishonim, this is the dominant Girsa, at least the early Rishonim. Shekol hamesaper biyetzias Mitzrayim hareze meshubach. Anyone who tells the story of the Exodus on the night of Pesach is praiseworthy. So Sally.
That implies that it's not a mitzvah.
Why?
Do it because you don't have, because you're getting extra, you know, praise if you do it. You're getting extra praise if you do it, means you don't have to do it.
Correct.
But there's another way to think of this.
All right, no.
You have to say Hallel, right? So you have to say Hallel. So if in addition to saying Hallel, you're also going to tell the story, now that's Meshubach.
Ah, okay. Right. So Sally's already bringing in something that we saw last time is present, at least potentially, in sources from the Second Temple period, which is the idea of singing accompanying the Karban Pesach. That may be the Hallel that we recite, or it may be an early manifestation of what eventually comes to be called Hallel. But in terms of what this means, so Sally before made the argument, Chol Amar B'Lasamper B'Tzias Mitzrayim Harizim Meshubach means, in other words, it's praiseworthy to expand upon the story of Pesach on Pesach night, means that there is a baseline obligation of telling some story, and if you tell more, that's better. So here, telling the story at all, that is praiseworthy. So that implies that if you don't tell it, so fine, you're not praiseworthy. But it doesn't mean you're bad. There's no mitzvah per se. There's no mitzvah. There is no biblical mitzvah.
Why is it praiseworthy to perform a mitzvah? Why does that take place if it's not?
So a good point. So in other words, it certainly is, Mr. Comet's correct. It certainly is praiseworthy to engage in mitzvahs. But that phraseology of hareze meshubach is always, but always, and in fact we're going to see in just a moment that this was very troubling for some of the later poskim. The phraseology of hareze meshubach, this is praiseworthy, is reserved exclusively for activities that are not obligatory. Yeah, excellent, right.
Reserved for activities where, like, generally Baal Tosef is not allowed, and this is reserved for activities where that's an exception to the rule there,
right?
Where you can add and therefore
it's
better to.
Right. So this again, that's an excellent question. This may lead us a little further afield, but generally Baal Tosef will manifest when you add on to a mitzvah. So in other words, if you dye all of the strings of your tzitzis tchelas, but here you're not. In other words, you. Baal Tosef may not come into play because you're not adding on to a to a pre-existing mitzvah, in which case you would need a permission to do so, which is how our Haggadah seems to reflect, right? In other words, there's a basic mitzvah to tell the story, and if you add on to it, that's permissible. Here, it seems to be saying there's no mitzvah at all. So if you want to tell the story of the Exodus, that's fine. It wouldn't be Baal Tosef, but it's fine. But that is an excellent point. Ms. Deegan.
Well, it seems to me from this that prior to this time when the Haggadah wasn't really quite as organized as it became,
right,
that it was not an obligation, and that it sort of became an obligation at the same time that practice got more organized.
Ah, so Mrs. Deegan is now already jumping ahead to what we're going to do at the end, which is saying, okay, fine, look. You made your point, right? You made your point. There's certainly a lot of confusion going on here, so at what point does it, at some point it must become a mitzvah, right? At some point it must become a mitzvah. It's an excellent point. We're going to save that for 3 minutes from now, and we're going to really answer the question of who makes this into a mitzvah? Who is responsible for... In other words, the answer, we already know the answer, is the Mechilta. But who brings the Mechilta back in when the Bavli and the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the Yerushalmi had seemingly boxed it out? So that's an excellent question. So quickly just take a look at source F, because source F responds to a point that Mr. Comet made, which I think is anticipated what source F is going to tell us. Source F is from the Avodah. We call him we've become accustomed to calling him the Avodah. One of the piyutim that occurs at the beginning of one of his works explains that his name comes from the fact that his name translates as Av Hamalos, which would mean, in other words, the father of great heights, which would mean that his name would have to be pronounced, if you're taking the Arabic seriously, Abu Dirham or Abu Darham. But if you have a yeshiva shesprach, then you call him the Avodah. That's what we're gonna do. Okay, the Avodah says, Hachi Garsinan, V'chol Hamar Belasaper B'tzias Mitzrayim Hareza Meshubach. He says, this is our textual tradition. This was the Avodah's textual tradition, the one that he got from his parents. Anyone who relates at length the story of the Exodus is praiseworthy. Or rather, not at length. Yeah, sorry, at length. Anyone who relates the story at length is praiseworthy. So at length, you're praiseworthy, but you certainly have to relate something. And he says, why do we have that girsa? Why do we have the tradition that, and this is the tradition that's reflected in our Haggadahs, why do we maintain that that is the correct version? He says, because the other version cannot be. He says, V'lo garsinan, v'chol ha-masaper b'tzias Mitzrayim. He says, it cannot be that we do not retain the textual tradition, and whosoever relates the story of the Exodus is praiseworthy. In other words, if you do anything at all, that's not obligatory, it's just praiseworthy, which is the dominant girsa in his time. He says, V'lo garsinan, we don't follow that. Why? The Kevan Shehi Mitzvah Aleinu, Lo Amrinam Ba Harezem Ashubach, Ela Machuyav Ulasos Mashin Etztaveh, Aval Hadar Garsinam Chalam Asaper, Vachalam Arba Lasaper, Nicha. He says, the Girsa that we found in the earliest versions in the Seder of Amram Gaon can't be. Because we do not say with respect, rather, for since relating the story on Pesach night is incumbent upon us, it's a mitzvah aleinu, we do not say with respect to it that one who relates it is praiseworthy. Rather, one is obligated to do what one is commanded. It's not just that it's praiseworthy. But according to how we render the text, and whosoever relates at length is praiseworthy, then it makes sense. Satisfactory. Nicha. Okay. Last point in terms of figuring out what mitzvah means. So take a look at this last source, G, from the Tosefta. This is one example we could draw. I mean, there could be any number of examples that we could have drawn. This is a random one. It may be the earliest one as well, or the clearest one, the clearest of the early examples. Mitzvah lazon esabanos v'ein sarch lomar esabanim. The Bavli has the reverse as well. Rabbi Yochanan Broka omer chova lazon esabanos. So according to the Tosefta, talking about the obligation that a husband has to support his children, which is stipulated in the ketubah in the rabbinic period. So it is a mitzvah to support your daughters, and certainly it's a mitzvah to support your sons. And the Bavli has the Kal V'chomer go the other way as well, but in the Tosefta it goes this way. And Rabbi Yochanan says it's not a mitzvah to support your daughters, it's a chova to support your daughters. So what does chova mean? What must chova mean? Like chiyuv, chayuv, an obligation. You must. So if chova is contrasting with mitzvah, so what does mitzvah mean in this case? It's not a chova. It's a mitzvah.
A nice thing.
It's nice. You ought to. You needn't, but you ought to. So I would suggest, and not the first person to make the suggestion, David Henschke is a major Talmud Chacham who lives in Har Nof and teaches at Bar Ilan, suggested that perhaps mitzvah aleinu l'stop b'tzias Mitzrayim, it is a mitzvah for us to tell the story of the Exodus on Pesach night. So perhaps even according to Rav Amram Gaon, it needn't mean that there is an obligation to do so. It means it's a nice thing to do so. It's a mitzvah to do so. It's not a chova. It's a mitzvah. And if you do it at all, hari zeh meshubach. It's nice. Certainly a good thing. But it's not an obligation.
Is the word mitzvah being used loosely?
Right. So the question. So it happens to be that in Tannaitic literature, the word mitzvah can mean a couple of different things. It can mean, it can be used in a broad sort of teleological sense, like in other words, saying the mitzvah is X, Y, and Z, but the preferred way to do it is A, B, and C. So mitzvah there would mean, this is the, broadly speaking, how it can be, this is, the mitzvah represents the range of options for how something can be done, but the best way to do it is A, B, and C. Or it can be used to mean exactly what chova means here. There are many sources where mitzvah just means obligation as opposed to reshus, as opposed to something optional. And then sometimes it can mean what we've seen it mean here. But it's a good question. The word mitzvah is actually quite slippery. It can mean different things. So now we're going to get back to Mrs. Deegan's question. Okay, fine. Enough already. We figured out that there is, even in the Babylonian version, certainly in the Eretz Yisrael versions, in the Babylonian version, in the earliest attestations that we have of it, there doesn't seem to be a bona fide obligation to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim on Pesach night. That would solve all of our problems. In other words, we don't have two mitzvos. We don't have Sipor on Pesach night and Zechira the rest of the year round. There's one mitzvah, biblically, there's a mitzvah to do Zechira the rest of the year round. Rabbinically, or maybe even less than that, we have a mitzvah to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim on Pesach night. Certainly rabbinically. The Mishnah has it, the Bavli has it, everybody has some sort of obligation, but it's not biblical. So who makes it biblical? Who resurrects the Mechilta? As usual, if we had time to do more of the Rambam in the context of this class, we would see that this is very much, as per usual, it's the Rambam who brings back the Mechilta. The Rambam is famous for citing sources as normative other than the Talmud Bavli, other than the Babylonian Talmud. Contrary to what I think some might assert, the Rambam never paskins against the Bavli in favor of, let's say, the Yerushalmi or the Mechilta, but when it doesn't conflict with the Bavli, so the Rambam will often resurrect for the purposes of halacha or accept for the purposes of halacha sources like the Yerushalmi and the Mechilta and so forth. But in terms of contradicting the Bavli, the Rambam is very clear in his introduction to the Mishnah Torah that he wouldn't do that. So take a look at source 3a. Source 3a, the Rambam tells us in source 3a, the Hamitzvah Hakufnun Zayin Hi, Shetziva, rather Shetzivanu L'Saber B'Tzias Mitzrayim B'Lach Hamisha Asu B'Nisim B'Tchilas Ha'ayla K'Vitzachas Lashon HaMasaper. In the Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam tells us that the 157th positive commandment is that which He commanded us to relate, that which God commanded us to relate the story of the Exodus on Pesach night, the evening of the 15th of Nisan, at the beginning of the evening, according to the Tzachas Lashon HaMasaper, according to the degree of eloquence that the teller, the narrator, possesses. The Hakasiv Shabala Tzivoy Hazeh, Hu Amri Yisrael, and what is the scriptural source for such a biblical obligation? So as we would expect, because we've learned the Mechilta, V'higadat alavincha bayom hahu, you shall tell your son on that day. And he says, Uva hafeir sham u'mechilta, or probably ba'mechilta, V'higadat alavincha yacham e'rosh chodesh, tamad lomar bayom hahu, I bayom hahu yacham e'bod yom, tamad lomar ba'avor zeh, ba'avor zeh lo amarti, el b'shosh she'ish matza u'mara munachem lefanecha, klom b'tchilas alay l'chayev atal asaper. We've seen this source already in source 1a, so I'm not going to review it, but the Rambam here quotes the very Mechilta that we saw. So the Rambam is the one who resurrects the notion of telling the story on Pesach night as a biblical commandment. So it's not surprising that the question of how we can have Sipur and Zechira at the same time does not arise until way after the Rambam in the period of the Achronim. So much so that take a look at the next source. The next source is from Rav Yerucham Fishel Perlo. Who is Rav Yerucham Fishel Perlo? Rabbeinu Yerucham. Ah, no, excellent question. There is a famous Rishon, Rabbeinu Yerucham, who's quoted often by the Beis Yosef. It's a different Rabbeinu Yerucham, but good suggestion. This Rabbeinu Yerucham Fishel Perlo is a rather modern scholar from the 19th, 20th century. Rabbeinu Yerucham Fishel Perlo was a staggering Talmud Chacham who wrote a commentary on a genre of literature, one example of a genre of literature known as well. Essentially, there were early figures who wrote, who attempted to sort of begin the process of counting up all of the mitzvos in the Torah. Now the Rambam just does it by listing them, but one of the forms that was very popular was not to have a list, but to actually write it out in poetic form. So you would have these poems, like called azharos. You would have these poems that would sort of, in beautiful poetic language, but often cryptic poetic language, lay out all of the mitzvos in the Torah. One famous such poem was composed by Rav Sajigon, and it's an extremely difficult text. So Rav Yerucham Fishel Perlo composes this magnificent commentary, a brilliant, lengthy commentary on this piyut, on this poem by Rav Sajigon, which he uses as a springboard to explicate all of the different views of Rav Sajigon and those who argued with him. So in this case, Rav Yerucham Fishel Perlo observes the following about Rav Sajigon's treatment of the very same topic that the Rambam we just saw dealt with. He says, "Iber da chazina leila Rabbeinu Agaon Zal, shelo mana mitzvah sipur yitzias mitzrayim b'minyan ha'esin, v'davar mat miyatuva, l'chora do ha'avalei asei mufuresh es bikra, d'chse v'igadat alavincha b'yom ahu." V'omnam, Rabbeinu Agaon Zal einenu yachid b'davar zeh, shegam habal halachos gedolos, v'reb elayo azakin, Rav Shlomo ben Gabirol Zal, lo mano asei zo minyan ha'esin shalahem, v'gam lahara'im zal b'yireim, ra'isi shehishmit mitzvah asei zo, v'lo mana b'minyan ha'mitzvah sayin shem. So he says, "Indeed I have seen that Rav Sajigon does not count the commandment of relating the story of the Exodus on Pesach night as a commandment." And he says, "This is astonishing. How could it be? We've all seen the Rambam. Seemingly, it's a positive commandment that is explicit in a verse, right? It's written, 'You shall tell your son on that day.' We've dealt with this problem." But he says, "Indeed, Sajigon is not alone in this matter. For not only does Rav Sajigon not quote this as a biblical commandment, but the Bahag, the Halachos Gedolos, Rebbe Leo Zakin, who authored a similar poem to Rav Sajigon, does not count it. Rav Shlomo ibn Gambirol, who also counts up all the mitzvos, does not count this as a positive commandment. And Relazar bar Shmuel of Metz, who wrote the Sefer Yerayim, also doesn't count this as a commandment. So, no one before the Rambam counted Sipur B'Yetzias Mitzrayim as a biblical commandment. It simply didn't exist. The Rambam brings it back in. Now, we have to ask ourselves, in light of this source here, if the Haggadah is not a biblical institution, and I think that we've demonstrated beyond the shadow of a doubt that it is not, why have we accepted in one form or another, whether we pass them like the Rambam, or whether we paskin against the Mechilta, why have we accepted the notion that the Haggadah is a biblical obligation? And then with this we'll close. I think the answer has to be, huh?
You're sort of obligated to observe this night. And so I guess you sort of have to acquire a procedure to observe it, and that's where this came from, to make it uniform in a number of places.
Right. So I think that's an excellent suggestion, but it runs into problems with the following case, right? In other words, what Mrs. Deegan is saying, I think, is intuitive, right? Which is, this is something that draws us together. But now we have to ask the question, so what were Jews doing for 1,500 years? Mm-hmm. Right? Nothing. So Mrs. Deegan's correct. They weren't doing anything. Why not?
Because no one told
them to. Aha, right.
Sometimes things get lost. Look at the problem we have today, currently.
Right.
With Yom HaTzvaot.
Right, true.
What's the structure?
So it's true. Structure. So true. It's. No, no. What's the question?
Is it a mitzvah to say
halal? So the answer is that halal certainly accompanies the Karban Pesach and early stage. But that actually so now we have to ask the question. Why isn't it enough? And this is, I think, a question that we all need to ask at our Siddurim this Pesach.
Okay.
Why is it not enough to just do the mitzvos? In other words, isn't that enough to bring us together? For example, let's in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, we have a Karban Pesach. Even after the Beis Hamikdash has been destroyed, let's sing Hallel. Well, Hallel we've certainly kept up. Arbakosos. The whole structure, right? So, why do we need to tell a story?
What else would you say?
We can say Kriya Shema, or we can the Karban Pesach itself is Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim.
I mean, this has to be something that's unique to the occasion.
Something that
could be done every other time during the year.
So Mr. Comet is saying something very important. There needs to be something unique to the occasion of Pesach. So my question is, why? There's no mitzvah that we do anything unique about the story of. There's no unique requirement to remember Pesach on Pesach, as counterintuitive as that seems, other than by doing what God told us, namely slaughtering things. And yes.
Well, we know that there's been a minhag prior to the Haggadah of the concept of a gathering and doing some form of reenactment.
Now we're moving.
We know that.
Excellent.
It's never in the Mishnah that we learned. It is a mitzvah to have poor, to invite the poor people. It is a mitzvah to have a group.
It certainly is implied very strongly in Chumash already that this is a family occasion, right? Everybody.
Or poor people, or whatever.
Right. Everybody. Right. Everybody. Everybody is involved.
You have to be able to finish it on that night.
Chol mitzvahs, right? Mitzvahs, mitzvahs, nefashos.
You got my family, and the family. You have to have enough. You get more than one family.
Right.
And you invite them on this.
Yeah. So tying all of this intuition together, here's what I want to suggest. When there is an institution in our lives that, without this, ties us all together, I think it's fundamentally true that perhaps telling the story specifically on Pesach night isn't necessary to bring us all together. What institution could have kept us all together? At a time when we might not have needed a Haggadah, what institution could we have? What? The Karban Pesach. And this is actually Machlokas Achronim, but broadly speaking, what institution is required? Not in a strict sense, but what institution do we presuppose when we talk about bringing Karban Pesach? When was the last time we brought a Karban Pesach? The Beis Hamikdash. When there was a central temple, a place where all of us were naturally drawn. A place that made it clear to everyone who wasn't there that their celebration was somehow incomplete, insufficient, if they were not there. If all of Israel could understand that Pesach and everything that it means for our genesis as a people revolves around the concept of us all being together under one roof, as it were, as one family, then the Haggadah is fundamentally superfluous. Now, the first Beis Hamikdash is destroyed. And it's possible, and I say this with due hesitation of being Motzi Lazal HaRishonim, of denigrating our ancestors, it's possible that our ancestors did not perceive at that time the danger that confronted the Jewish people of leaving a temple context without something else that could hold all of the Jewish people together under that one family roof. So the Jewish people went into exile in Babylonia, much like their brethren to the north, their brothers and sisters to the north, the other tribes went before them. What happened to those tribes? They're lost to history. They're gone. our ancestors went into Babylonia, and they had no idea what was waiting for them there. And of course, when the time comes to come back to rebuild another temple, how many people come back? 99%, which is what you would expect when Jeremiah had promised the people, in 70 years they're going to come back. How many people came back? 99%? No. 80%? No. 50%? No one came back. It was nothing. The bonds that had held our people together had been sundered, and they could not be reconstituted. And so the second time around, when the Beis HaMikdash, having been rebuilt against all odds, was destroyed again, Chazal, the Ba'alei HaMasorah, the bearers of our tradition, understood that the same mistake could not be made twice. Pesach needed to remain forever a holiday that brought us together around the same table, under the same roof, speaking the same language. That is the only way for us as a people to appreciate that we're not just an ethnicity, although we are an ethnicity to an extent. We're not just a faith, although there is a faith component to our religion. We're not Catholicism. We're not just a political entity, although we have politics. We're a family. We are literally brothers and sisters, with all that that entails. We are a people with a history, with a story. And we can't wave away that story. If the story is false, then we as a people have no purpose. There are people nowadays who will pretend that if the story is false, not a big deal. We are invested, it seems to me, in the truth of that story, because it's what constitutes us as a people. And Pesach is the holiday upon which we affirm that that is the case. If we never left Egypt and never actively agreed to a covenant with God, then everything that we're doing is a joke. If we never made a covenant with God, then either God pretended that we made a covenant with him, in which case, Rachman al-Tzlan, God forbid, no pun intended, he's a liar, chas v'shalom, or this is just a game that we humans have made up. We are invested in this story being true. The question of what that means, we can leave for another shir, and I'm going to give that shir, but we are invested in some truth component to this narrative. And Pesach is the holiday upon which we affirm that. And in the absence of a temple, in the absence of being able to witness God in our midst, which is another way that our history can be confirmed, by literally seeing the effects of God, we need a story. We need to affirm every year that this is our story and it's what constitutes us as a people. And that is why only once the temple has been destroyed, a second time, and the lesson of the first destruction, the bitter lesson of the first destruction has been learned, does the Haggadah spring into existence. And that is how we get to our story today. So I hope that each and every one of us will have the opportunity to discuss this question of what does the Haggadah do for us? Why is the Haggadah important? Why is it important that we're doing something that isn't technically, at least as best as we can ascertain, really a mitzvah, at least unless we pass on like the Rambam, which perhaps we should. Why are we doing all of this? Why is this important? I hope that will enrich all of our siddurim, and since we're not going to meet a week from this Monday, since we're not going to meet this coming Monday, I will wish those who are not planning to attend the clergy pearls, or who are not going to be here this Shabbos, and in which case I'll see you, a very happy Pesach, and hopefully we'll see everybody this Shabbos, and I'll see everyone at the clergy pearls, in which case we can postpone that Chag Pesach Sameach for next time. All right, Yashikach. Yes, this comment.